You're standing and you're imaging the central axis for your body. The axis itself is not going to move through space. When you did this, you were moving the axis through space with you. This time, you're going to simply move around it by taking little steps to the side, staying in an imaginary circle with your feet, moving around the axis. Now let me show you what needs to be avoided if possible. Moving the axis in space. I did it in a very large way, but many of us will deviate from that axis in a more subtle way. What you want to do is just imagine that that is like a pole running through your body and that you're going to move right around it. Okay, let me just, I know that you've probably seen some of the Mideastern dances in which the dancer will put the finger up here. That's what they're doing. They're creating an axis. They're creating an axis right through the body. If that helps you, you can do that. It's up to you. But I want you to get a sense of moving around the axis. Do one 360-degree turn and then just pause. Try that. Just play with it. Have some fun. You know, don't be too careful. And then once you've done 360 degrees, just pause. We'll wait for everybody to finish. A little bouncing on the femur heads. Are you evenly on the two? All right. Now one more time in the same direction. Okay, again, let's balance on the femur heads and renew our sense of the central axis. And let's add one more thing to that. The axis is perpendicular to the floor. Perpendicular to the floor. Just bring that into your awareness, your consciousness. And let's turn the opposite direction, one 360-degree turn around the axis. Pause, and then once again, let's rotate around the central axis. And pause when you've made the 360 degree turn, and again, let's just bounce on the femur heads. Now, once again, let's walk and carry the axis around with us. And then when you've explored that to your satisfaction, have a seat, and we'll talk about a little more material. Thank you. As we leave this for the time being, we'll continue that tomorrow. I want to separate fact from imagery. As you were moving, I asked you to image the axis running through the center of your body. And it does that. But that is actually, strictly speaking, for the standing position, that fundamental standing position when you have your weight on both legs. When you take a step, as you shift your weight to the supporting leg for that instant, the center of gravity shifts toward the supporting leg very slightly, and with it the axis of gravity. When the movement is good, the shift is minimal. For that reason, I didn't ask you to shift the axis in your thinking, but rather to think the axis in the center of the body, even though it's actually shifting, and that will tend to help you center the weight and move more efficiently. But I just wanted you to know the fact from the image. Now, on the screen you see a spine side view, and I want to talk with you about the spine and build a few images. I'll move through this information rather quickly, and then we'll go into constructive rest, and we're going to do some tactile aid for the spine. Actually, we're not going to do a regular constructive rest. We're going to be working on our sides. The spine is, first of all, a multi-jointed structure. And that is to say, it's not one solid piece of material, but rather is composed of segments, which we call vertebrae. And these segments, you can see on this skeleton here, you can see on the picture there. Looking at them from the front, they are rounded. And in between each of the rounded bodies of the vertebrae, as they're called, there is what is called an intervertebral disc, which is a tough fibrous cartilage called fibrocartilage. And that fibrocartilage makes up about 1/4 the length of the human spine. It's pretty important in our visualization, our imaging, our concept of it. The cartilage serves two major functions. One, it cushions the shock of the weight going through the spine, because every time you take a step, there's a tremendous force passing through the compression members of your body, the bones. And these discs serve to cushion that shock. The second important function they serve is to permit a larger range of movement than would be possible if you didn't have them. Now, looking at the spine from the posterior view, you see these little projections, which are really the spines of the spine. We call these processes, actually, spinous processes. These are the posterior ones that point directly to the bodies of the vertebrae, and the ones that flare out from the sides are the lateral posterior processes, which serve as anchors for muscles and ligaments, and they also protect the spinal cord, which is in front of them. If you look at the formation of the vertebra, forming out from the body of the vertebra are these processes, and within, and as I say, in front of the processes, there's a little circle. You put the circles together, you stack them, and you have a canal. And in that canal, the spinal cord fits. And that takes the vital nerve supply to the brain. So it needs a lot of protection, and these do give that to them in back and on the sides. And in front, of course, you have the the bodies of the vertebrae, which are in front of the spinal cord, and they offer a tremendous amount of protection there. Let's look at the terminology for the spine. In just a couple of minutes, I can show you how you can memorize all the vertebrae of the spine if you don't already know it. Some of you know anatomy already. But they are organized in sections. The first seven vertebrae are called the cervical vertebrae. That's your neck. The next 12 vertebrae, you have ribs attached to them. We call those thoracic. Seven cervical, then 12 thoracic. Immediately below that, you have the five lumbar, which are the small of your back. And then below that, you have this solid sheath here called the sacrum, which is five fused vertebrae that in children is somewhat movable. Below the sacrum, we have the coccyx, which can be anywhere from three to five semi-fused vertebrae. Those are the bones of the spine, roughly. The 24 movable ones plus the sacrum and the coccyx. Spine has curves, as you might notice from that side view and looking at the skeleton from the side. And these curves are important because they permit the spine to do its peculiar job. It has to support weight. It also has to move that weight that it's supporting. And the most efficient structure for that is a curved structure so that movement can flow smoothly through the spine as you locomote. So, in our work, we're not trying to straighten the spine, as sometimes we're advised to do by well-meaning posture teachers or parents or any kind of teachers. We're not trying to do that, but it's more that we're trying to center the spine through lengthening it. And indeed, we don't want the curves to be too pronounced. That is to say, those curves should be there, but they should not be overly curved. Let's look at a simple mechanical drawing of this. Draw with this, but I'll see. Okay, if you have a weight here on a curve, it tends to increase the curvature. If, however, I'm going to do it this way. I want to change the presentation a little bit. You have a series of curves. You have another mechanical law coming into effect, which is that if the curves are opposite, alternating, the tendency to weight bending the curves is reduced. And that's a basic law of mechanics. So we want to have curves in the spine, but we don't want them to be too pronounced, and we need more than one in order to establish a balance of the curves. By having a series, when you have a weight on this structure, it's going to be less likely, that is, the weight has less of a tendency to bend the curves, since the curves changing direction help to balance the load. Now, I want to go back to what I started to say. If you have the gravity line here, and you have a curve such as the one that I drew here, then you can see that the weights that are being transmitted through these curves are close enough to the gravity line so that there can be some kind of a balance. If, on the other hand, you have very pronounced curves, the weights are so far from the gravity line that you're going to have to compensate with an awful lot of muscle work to keep the structure upright. So that's what we're into when we talk about lengthening the spine. But there's a little bit of a problem there. I said that the ideal postural pattern is not absolute, which includes the curves of the spine. That is to say, not everyone is going to have the same spinal curvature. And the sacral. And the first differentiation takes place in the cervical, forming the cervical curve, and then later the lumbar curve. Now, if the child is born with a very deep primary curve, then the other curves are going to be compensatory. So, it's very dangerous to try to compare your own curve to somebody else's. In other words, if you're sitting next to someone whose curves appear to be very shallow and you feel that yours should be the same, that's not really a valid goal. Aside from the fact that there's an individual difference in the curvatures of spines to begin with, there is also an individual appearance which is caused by the fact that when you put flesh here over these curves, you can't really tell what's under it. If you look at these processes here, notice they are almost perpendicular to the bodies of the vertebrae here. And you put flesh over that and account for, allow for, the individual variation in muscle and flesh development on persons. Some people look as if they have a flat back. Well, the back may be flat, but not the spine. And by the same token, these processes point down very sharply. So put flesh over that, compared to what you have here with these perpendicular position, I've seen people look as if they have an absolutely flat back. And that's only an illusion, because everyone has curves, and should have them at least. But you really can't tell. So that's another reason why we work the way we do. We're trying, through creativity and working with the body and the tactile aid, the creativity and the process and the image, to help the body find its own ideal curvature, its own ideal postural pattern. And that's the first line of movement that we had, the lengthening of the spine downward. You remember those 9 lines of movement. Now, that is what we're going to work on in just a couple of minutes. We'll be going into the side-lying position, and we're going to be working on that. I'd like to make just a couple of more comments about the spine. I said that a child has one curve, a primary curve when he's born. And that differentiates into the 4 curves. This, for those of you who may be involved in rearing children, whatever capacities, teachers or parents, or simply friends, it's not a good idea to force a child to stand or sit before they're ready. Now, how do you know they're ready? They tell you, you don't tell them. The child, if allowed to develop properly, unless there's some problem which can occur, but not usually does it occur, will, through its little movements, those little movements they do, the kicking, rolling, crawling, creeping, crying, all of those activities tend to develop the muscles which help develop and establish the curves of the spine. When that process has come to a point at which there's sufficient strength there for the curves to be maintained in an upright position, the child will begin to sit. It's usually preceded quite a bit with a lot of creeping on all fours as opposed to crawling on the belly. And very shortly thereafter, it will begin to stand and walk. The timing of that varies in individual. It's like each person has a biological time clock within them. And if a child walks earlier or sits up earlier than another child, it doesn't mean that child is superior, really. It's just that the timing is different in the two children, if you might be comparing them. What can thwart that, among the many things that can thwart it, that process of development, is if the child isn't allowed a proper space to move in. It really needs either a room or a small room or part of a room with a lot of space, a rug, a warm rug, and no sharp objects around where it can move, it can roll, it can crawl, it can creep very freely and move pretty much as much as it wants to. What tends to depress that process, to interfere with it, to inhibit it, is cooping a child up in a crib all day long. That's not a good idea, because then they don't get a chance to do the movements they need to do. Then the process can be thwarted, slowed, inhibited. Those little devices that make the child sit up, do avoid them. They can be used after the child is strong enough to sit up. But don't force the child to sit up. I feel that a psychological and physiological trauma is established in some children. It wouldn't happen in all of them, but in some, if they are forced to sit up or stand up too soon. Now, let's do this to help our imagery of lengthening the spine. We have talked about smoothing of the horizontal wrinkles downward, which is a very good image. But I want to be more specific today so you really get to zero in on lengthening the spine. I'm going to start off very generally by using an image of the coccyx. Now, anthropologists tell us that the coccyx is a vestigial tail. And what they mean by that is that at one time, according to the theory of anthropology, we had full-grown tails as members of the primate family, our antecedents. As a matter of fact, it's thought to have been prehensile. That is, it has grasping properties. You know, monkeys can pick things up with their tails. And that this that we have here, this thing we call the coccyx, is a vestige of that at one time full-grown tail. It is atrophied as a result of non-use. What we're going to do this morning is to devolve instead of evolve. Back into eons of time, we're going to regrow the tale through imagery. So touch your coccyx now. You can feel it. All right. And now watch the coccyx in your imagination grow into a longer and longer and longer tail. It'll curve slightly forward, following the curvature you see there, forward to the knees and then in between the ankles and on down through the floor, as long as you want to see it. Now, I'm going to have all of us do a little exercise to get into the spirit of this, and then I'm going to be very specific. This is a little general, but it's just to get you into this. Come to standing now, and image the tail growing, and if you want to have some fun with it, image the tail of your favorite animal. If you're friendly with a cat, a dog, or like monkeys or any tail, pigs, any tail that you like to image, you can do, even a dinosaur's tail. Back in my day, that's what they had. So let's do some walking now, imaging a long, long tail growing longer as you walk. Just have some fun with it. I just want you to get into the spirit of this before I get very specific. Don't step on your tail. Yeah, you can swing it around. Okay, now just stand wherever you happen to be for a moment, and let's go back to the idea of resting the weight on the femur heads and letting the great trochanters melt down the sides of the legs. And you can do a little bouncing with that if you like. And as you bounce on the femur head, just tell yourself that you can let the great trochanters melt down the sides of your legs because the femur heads are supporting the weight. So you don't need to hold yourself up by your great trochanters. And the sit bones can melt down the backs of your legs because the femur heads are giving you support. So let them melt down the backs of your legs. And the spine, the tail of the spine, can grow down to the heels. You can release the tail of your spine because your weight is resting on your femur heads. You don't have to hold yourself up by your coccyx. Let go of it. Release it. Let the weight rest on the femur heads. If you want to bounce a little to activate it, all right, you don't have to. So you got 3 points now that are non-support points, the great trochanters, the sit bones, and the coccyx. Todd used to say, Never use your coccyx as a lever for leverage action. That's what she meant. Just what I showed you. Now, here's what we're going to do lying on our sides. We're going to watch the processes here as if they themselves were little tails dropping down. And while you're lying on your side, we're going to touch you on the individual processes. We'll start down around mid-sacrum and work our way up as high as we can get. We'll get to shoulder level. We may not do every one between the sacrum and the shoulders, but we'll do many of them, or most of them. So the image is very simple. As your partner is touching you on the process, you're going to see the process fold downward. It could even lengthen downward. And as we get to certain stages, and you can do it in your mind anytime you want to, even though we don't say it, I'm going to ask you to think of the one that you're on as it tumbles downward or lengthens downward or folds downward, triggering off the ones below it. So they all tumble down in a flowing action like a row of dominoes, and all of that merges into the tail image. So that no matter where you are, as you think about the processes dropping, it's always a flowing action that extends on into the tail image of the tailbone lengthening. Now, when we're down in the sacrum, we're going to have to estimate the space between the processes because they are quite small down here. As you get up into the lumbar and higher, you'll be able to feel them because they project very definitely outward. So we can just go from one to the other, you'll feel them. All right, let's set the mats up. And I want you to lie on your side, and you're going to need more support than you did for your head when you lie on your back.